The clerk will call the docket.
Jesse Burrows, John Singer, the Commonwealth Attorney, Robert A. May, Assistant Public Defender of the Appellate, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Catherine Quinn, and the LPO, Assistant Attorney General, Seattle.
You may proceed. You may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Justices, may it please the court. My name is Robert May, and I'm here on behalf of Desi Terrell Johnson. Appellant's argument and the court's remedy today is very simple. The admission of evidence in violation of appellant's due process rights was an error of law and thus an abuse of discretion. The evidence admitted in error was not harmless, as it affected appellant's punishment.
Can I ask you the first question on this subject? You don't really argue there was a due process violation in your brief. You argue that you assume there's a due process violation, and then you say the Court of Appeals was wrong in declaring it harmless. But we're a writ of error court. Great papers, we look at judgments, and the Court of Appeals' judgment was to affirm the conviction. But before us, you don't present any briefing, at least that I saw, that directly addressed the underlying question of due process. It's a complicated reliability test. You know it. You've argued it. But it's not before us.
That's true. It wasn't put back before me. The Court of Appeals assumed without deciding that the evidence should not have come in. And then their only order, or that I could see from examining, was that it was a harmless error. Unfortunately, I can only appeal the decisions they make.
What the decision they made, the judgment they made, was to affirm the conviction. The reasoning, as you can tell from reading any opinion issued by an appellate court, can be a lot of different things. You don't appeal reasoning, you appeal judgments, particularly in a writ of error court, which is what we are. I'm struggling with the logic of this, because if you want me to vote to vacate conviction, you've got to persuade me, one, that there's error, and two, that it's not harmless. But as you properly conceded, you've not argued before us that there is error. And it doesn't really matter, from my perspective, whether the Court of Appeals went to harmless error first or second. The question is, do I reverse the Court of Appeals for affirming the conviction? And so what is it in my logic that you're not agreeing with?
Well, we've conceded that the conviction is valid. We've conceded that the revocation of his suspended sentence is valid. It's not what we're arguing. It's not the remedy.
I get that, the sentencing order. Right. But, I mean, you've not argued the due process argument. You've assumed it away by the nature of your argument. You've only focused on the harmless error point, which was the rationale of the Court of Appeals judgment. It wasn't, in fact, the judgment. The judgment is conviction affirmed.
And I understand the conviction being affirmed, Justice, but the actual due process issue was removed from me when the Court of Appeals assumed without citing that the evidence should not have come in and simply made a harmless error.
It was removed for purposes of their syllogism. It wasn't removed for you. Your whole point on appeal was to say there was error and it wasn't harmless. How is the first premise of your argument removed from you?
Well, I'm going to turn to my brief, Your Honor, where I looked at a Supreme Court rule that said that
Right, it's Rule 517,
yes.
C1-2, which talks about the nature of assignments of error in appeals from the Court of Appeals, and it says it can only assign error to assignments of error presented in and to actions taken by the Court of Appeals. So I take it you interpreted the rule to say, well, the action they took was to say harmless error, so that's what I am limited to by rule.
Yes, since they didn't actually make a ruling on whether the evidence should or should not have come in. They assumed it should not have come in and then said it was harmless error.
I would have thought the action taken is the judgment. not a paragraph out of a slip opinion. The action they took was they affirmed the judgment, the lower court's conviction judgment. That's the action courts take. Courts, when we write opinions, are not taking actions, we're explaining stuff. The action is what we do, which is affirm, reverse, remand, partly, etc. So I'm still not understanding the point.
When I look at the Turner case is very similar in the fact that they did not, they were not appealing the conviction, or as Yard was calling it, the action. The only part of the action that we contend, or that we have a problem with, is the sentencing. Perhaps I misinterpreted the rule. I don't believe that I did. If I can only, they're only holding us, because I'm looking at what the court says. What it does is say this is fine. But why it said this is fine, with the Court of Appeals, it said this is fine, is because the error was harmless, not because there was no error.
Can I, my last question on this point,
sure,
because I know you've got a lot more to get to, but we're duty-bound to ask the harmless error question, are we not? Even if the Commonwealth doesn't raise it, our cases are very clear, it's a sua sponte duty, not just an election, but a duty. How logical is it that we have a duty to ask the harmless error question and not a duty to ask the error question?
This court?
Yeah.
I can address the error. It was not addressed in my brief simply because I was responding to the Court of Appeals.
It's a little late to address the error at oral argument if there's a need to address the error on appeal.
And that's fine. And if the Court of Appeals would have actually made a decision, and it's a little frustrating on the appellant's end, I argued all that, or appellant argued all that in the Court of Appeals. They decided not to make a decision. They decided not to say whether it was error or not. As the Attorney General of the Commonwealth pointed out, if there was no error, if the evidence could have come in, there really wouldn't be a harmless error analysis if the error came in.
But that's not true at all. We very frequently say we have no opinion on error or not, but we know for sure it's harmless. There's no sequencing in that. Sometimes we go directly to harmless error without considering error at all. And to infer from that we think there is error is just not accurate.
Well, counsel, I think this issue was fairly bookended on either side of this bench. And I think you need to get to the merits of your argument. As far as addressing whether there's error, I think you ought to do that to the best of your ability here today.
At trial, and I'll argue this, at trial in the trial court, the appellant objected to the statements, the screenshots, and the letters that came in from two witnesses who weren't present. The reason we objected to that was the limited due process right under the 14th Amendment that appellant had to confront his accusers. Now, there are some exceptions and there are some tests, and I don't think that the tests are that complicated. It's reliability, and then it's the interests of basically the interests of the state in not bringing these people. Well, there was no independent verification of the reliability, and that was the problem that appellant was objecting to. All of the evidence, I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No.
Chief Justice. It was very circular reasoning. Even the court's adoption of it and allowing of it to come in was very circular. It was these two girls, I believe they were 17, their statements were consistent with their written statements, which were consistent with the screenshots that they sent in. But there was no independent verification, and that was appellant's issue, no independent verification. So it was a pinger application. The pinger application does not use, and this was established in the trial court, does not use the people's real numbers. So there was no numbers verified. No name was put forward. The court relied upon...
There are additional circumstances. I mean, this is not an instance of, let's say, a teenager is caught shoplifting, and so now she's facing charges, and so she has this motive to curry favor with the prosecution. Well, but there's a sex offender who was doing this to me, and it was the mother who flagged down the police officer, and then the police officer says, well, this is pretty serious. You're going to have to give me a written statement. So they actually handwrote it, and he testified live as to what happened, right? So aren't there at least some? I mean, I understand maybe perhaps there should be more, but aren't there at least some assurances of trustworthiness that are in this record?
No, because I can't. The only assurance of trustworthiness I could have gotten based on the limited the limited explanation we had was to actually speak to the girls or get something else. What we had was, because I don't know what the motive was, and no motive was put forward. I can speculate on lots of motives. But simply because it was like, you know how important this is, but, I mean, people lie under oath. Mr. Johnson was convicted of that, so we know people do it. So simply because it was a serious matter, which is what the prosecutor argued, simply because it was serious, then why would they lie? Well, people do it all the time. It's not for me to put forward a motive unless they can show that there was no motive. They didn't know his name. So the name and description is, for a sex offender, is a very easy thing to get. You could do any kind of internet search. You could put in your zip code, which is apparently what happened. You put in a zip code, you could choose these people at random. The Commonwealth is contending, but they're 17, so they're not 10 or 12, which was what the prosecutor at the trial argued. I don't think that makes it any more reliable just because they're 17. And it also cuts against their other argument. If they're reliable, they're 17, and they're Nancy Drews, then why can't a Nancy Drew come and testify?
One of the things the courts have said, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, is it's a more attenuated type of confrontation under this due process clause analysis. But if we accept your argument, aren't we essentially saying, well, in this context, it's tantamount to full dress, criminal trial, all-out confrontation. They have to be physically present and cross-examined. I'm having a hard time reconciling that with the more attenuated test that the Supreme Court has given us to apply.
Yes, Your Honor. But when Henderson looks at the things that can establish reliability, and just some of the examples that are put in Henderson itself, were police reports, detailed police reports, not letters. The Commonwealth compares letters from 17-year-old, I wasn't going to say witnesses, but they weren't, 17-year-old complainants, compares them to police reports. No police reports I've ever seen. They also had, so there was independent verification.
But what? I'm not following that, because police officers going out and talking to folks, and then later back at the station or maybe in this car or whatever is writing down, this is what they said to me. Well, here are the words of the actual people and what happened.
But they're also doing more. They're also putting forth their observations. In Henderson, they found that it was testifying about a robbery. They found in the car that Henderson and his friends were in, they found fruits of the crime. There were voicemails left by Henderson threatening the witnesses. So that failed on both tests, with the interests of the state and interests of the state versus the interests of the appellant or the accused. And the reliability, voicemails threatening the witnesses and then voicemails telling other people to threaten the witness or cause them bodily harm. So there was other independent verification.
But the question here is not whether those fact patterns pass the threshold due process mm-hmm. test of reliability, but whether an appellate court under abuse of discretion standard could tell a fact finder, in this case a trial judge, that his or her judgment as to the minimal threshold of due process reliability, not even closely approximating Crawford's confrontation clause analysis, whether no reasonable jurist could have come to that conclusion under these facts. Is that the proper standard of review or not?
No, the standard of review is whether there was error of law, and that's a de novo review.
So we have to make our own judgment as to whether or not there's enough motive in there. We don't defer under any abuse of discretion analysis.
The fact finder was there to listen to the witness, but in this case, the witnesses that they could have shown reliability weren't there, for one. So since it's a de novo review, you know, the court makes up its own mind.
So that's what we do in evidentiary cases. When there's evidence excluded or evidence admitted, we review that de novo?
Well, it depends on what the standard of review is. The standard of review here for an error of law constituting abuse of discretion is de novo. There are other standards for different errors of law, whether it's constitutional or not constitutional. Since this is a constitutional error, that's what we're contending, it's a de novo review.
So it's not abuse of discretion. De novo is not abuse of discretion. De novo is we make our own judgment, and it's actually irrelevant what the lower court's judgment is.
Well, yes, in a way. But it is, it's still a an abuse of discretion standard, since it's a revocation hearing and it's not a full-blown.
Okay. How did this trial judge abuse his or her discretion in determining that the minimal threshold of reliability was not reached?
Well, because there was no there were no independent checks. There was no reliability. So the courts can't just get it wrong. I mean, see, he has reasoning. He said, this is why I'm letting it in. But all the reasons he let it in, and I believe my time will shortly expire. The reason he let it in was because the women were young ladies were consistent with themselves, which is different. So the trial court did consider the cases that we put before, but it looked like they were new. So I don't know if the trial court had enough information at that point to properly apply the test.
Has he answered your question, Justice Kelsey?
Yes, thank you.
Right, your time has expired.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Catherine Adelpio on behalf of the Commonwealth. This Court should affirm the decisions of both the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court and deny Johnson a resentencing on his probation violation. The Circuit Court's implicit finding that good cause existed to refuse the defendant his right to confrontation was correct, and a de novo examination of this Court should reach the same conclusion. And to the extent that the Court of Appeals conducted a harmless error analysis and determined that any consideration of the hearsay was harmless, that determination is not reversible error because no due process violation occurred.
Does the Commonwealth have a view on the initial exchange we had with your opposing counsel about the need to attack the judgment itself and not simply the reasoning of the Court of Appeals? You know, the issue before the Court of Appeals was the admissibility of these statements. The Court of Appeals said, well, assuming error, harmless. So the question is, and so now counsel has attacked that specific holding without an assignment of error directed at the ultimate judgment, which was affirmance. So can we consider the harmless error and the due process question both, or are we limited in some way?
Your Honor, I suggest to the Court that it is not limited, and I suggest that Mr. Johnson is waived any challenge he had to the due process violation and the finding that no due process.
So then the answer is to dismiss the appeal, right?
That's
not, I mean, we would have nothing to do because an attack on a harmless error, well, then we wouldn't get to the error. We would have nothing to resolve.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Mr. Johnson could have assigned error to the Court of Appeals' failure to reach the merits of the due process.
Where do the rules say that?
I think that.
If the rule said that, I'd say, well, right. You have to go all the way and not just attack the reasoning, but also the underlying question that was at issue in the trial court. But I'm reading the rules, and it's just not apparent to me where that is found in the rules.
Well, Your Honor, if we look at Rule 5:17, I'd suggest that if, to borrow Mr. Johnson's argument, if he could only assign error to actions taken by the Court of Appeals, meaning that he could only assign error to their harmless error analysis, I think that part and parcel of that, he also has to accept that the decision not to reach the merits was an action that he could have challenged.
So the assumption and the decision not to address something is the action that needs to be challenged.
That's correct.
Okay.
What if we, like the Court of Appeals, assumed without deciding and concluded that it wasn't harmless error? What would we do? Would we send it back to the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, I think that given the record before this court. This court has everything it needs to make a good cause determination and determine that, in fact, the reliability and balancing tests were satisfied, so that this court could, in the use of judicial resources, could just reach a decision on the merits rather than remanding it to the Court of Appeals.
All right, so help us with that.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. The Circuit Court considered the hearsay statements of the two teenage girls. He considered both the verbal statements as related to him by Deputy Green, or excuse me, as related by them to Deputy Green. He considered the written statements, basically outlining the girls' contacts with Mr. Johnson, and he considered the screenshots of the online conversation that Johnson had with the girls. These statements bore sufficient indicia of trustworthiness.
Can I stop you right there?
Yes, sir.
Because it seems like to me the best argument for the other side concerning reliability here is a question as to whether or not the contacts were actually with Johnson as opposed to with someone else. Because my understanding is that the girls thought their contact was with Johnson because they had gone online to some website, watchtheneighborhood.com or something, and they assumed that this person that they saw on that website was Johnson. So that's how they connected Johnson to be the person who actually accosted him.
Well, Your Honor, I think that, and this is not necessarily a fact and evidence, but Sex Offender Registry contains the pictures of, online, you can see the pictures of the offenders.
Right, that does, but they didn't say that they looked at the Sex Offender Registry. They said they looked at something else.
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, they pulled up the Fredericksburg.com. This is also not in evidence, but one of the arguments made in the circuit court was that the websites that they went to did not actually discuss the fact that Johnson was a sex offender. And I don't think that, based on my own research, I don't think that is accurate. Fredericksburg.com, which was one of the websites that were referenced, talked about had an article, a news article about his rape from 10 years previously. And the other website that was cited either in the probation violation report or by Deputy Green verbally, I think that he didn't provide the website with enough specificity, the address of the website with enough specificity. And when you went to those, when you used a slightly different search, in fact, it did show that Johnson was on the sex offender registry. I think that given the fact that Deputy Green did conduct an investigation to confirm that Johnson lived in the area, that he, in fact, worked at Dollar General, just like the girls said that he, or just like he said in the statements that he worked in Dollar General, those facts tie him to the girls' allegations. And that is sufficient to demonstrate that that is a sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness with respect to their accounts. I suggest that the verbal testimony of Deputy Green in the circuit court is more trustworthy than the types of evidence enumerated by this court in Henderson. In Henderson, this court stated that detailed police reports were constituted a guarantee of trustworthiness. Certainly, the in-court testimony of an officer, who conducted the investigation, who was subject to cross-examination, is more trustworthy than a written statement.
Is it the officer's testimony that has to be trustworthy, or the facts on which the officer's testimony is based? Their argument is we have screenshots, written statements, and oral statements all coming from these 17-year-olds that track each other, but there is nothing other than their statements and the fact that he worked at Dollar General, which if they saw this gentleman, they might know that track it back, that tie it back to the defendant.
Your Honor, I would point to the fact that another indicia of trustworthiness is the failure of the defendant to contradict the evidence against him. He had notice of what the allegations were going to be. He provided no alibi. He provided no evidence to demonstrate that it was not him having these interactions with these two young girls. And I would just return to the fact that Deputy Green stated that he investigated the matter. He stated that he confirmed that Johnson lived in the area, that he worked in the same store that, or the same company, with the same company that the speaker to the girls worked with. And the deputy was able to evaluate the trustworthiness of the girls and essentially then vouched for them in the course of his testimony. He found that probable cause existed to contact the police officer and, the probation officer.
Does the burden beyond reasonable doubt apply to probation violations? Is probation violation preceding a criminal proceeding?
No, Your Honor.
So we're now discussing not so much the burden of proof of the underlying facts, but the admissibility of facts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In a proceeding where the hearsay rules do not strictly apply, the Confrontation Clause does not strictly apply, and we're dealing with very low thresholds and an abuse of discretion standard on appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would note that the statements offered by, the statements conveyed by Deputy Green did not, were not included in multiple layers of hearsay. They did not merely reflect an adversarial relationship between the out-of-court declarant and the defendant. And those are some things that were discussed in Henderson as things that would detract from the guarantee of trustworthiness. And I already stated this, but I just want to return to it because Justice McCullough pointed it out. The girls' own written statements regarding their interactions with the defendant were admitted. And this is similar to what Morrissey in the Supreme Court of the United States stated, that things like letters are admissible in probation violation hearings. And I would just briefly also address the balancing test, which was also discussed in the Henderson case in this court. The out-of-court declarants were teenage girls. The defendant was a rapist. He had already contacted Deputy Green to demand the names and ages of the women who were making allegations against him. This, coupled with Johnson's aggressive nature, as evidenced by the testimony of the probation officers, both Adkins and her supervisor, Terry, satisfied.
Is he detained prior to this hearing, or is he at liberty?
Well, he had been detained on unrelated issues. He had a felony perjury charge.
Right. So what my question goes to is a legitimate concern, I think, by the government for the safety of these girls. So if he's incarcerated, that would be lessened.
Correct.
If he's at liberty, that would be heightened.
Correct. And the felony perjury charge was not even the worst offense that he was investigated for. He'd been investigated for both a robbery and for a malicious wounding.
Okay, my question is, was he detained at the time they're getting ready for this probation revocation hearing?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that off the top of my head.
And I guess the other thing I kind of don't understand about that argument is whether they give their statement in person or whether they give it in writing, it's not going to happen until you have the probation revocation hearing. And he certainly can't do anything to them in the courtroom.
But he knows where they live. It would be another contact with them, and he knows the area.
But he still does, doesn't he? I mean, the fact that they weren't there doesn't prevent him from knowing that information.
Well, at the time, I suppose that yes, there were.
At the time
he wrote to Green, he did not know their names, but the names were given at the probation revocation hearing. I just point out to the court that in Henderson, the court, in conducting the balancing test, found that the declarant's fear for their safety was a valid concern to consider in conducting the balancing test.
Right, and that's why I want to see whether, in this instance, there was any a valid concern, and whether it would in any way be increased by the fact that they were there in person as opposed to having their statements there. Well, and I kind of don't see where the danger is increased by being there as opposed to making a statement that's there. I kind of don't see that.
This was not an argument made in the circuit court, but I'd suggest the psychic injury of having to testify against someone when it's not necessary. It is one thing having to face this person, again, allowing him to put a face to the girls who are making allegations against them. He would be in the courtroom with them, have the opportunity to see them, know again exactly the identity of the girls who have made the allegations against him. And I think that any additional contact increases the security risk for the girls. And
did Johnson, at any point in the evidentiary hearing, proffer a hypothesis for why two 17-year-old girls would pick him out of all the sex offenders in Virginia to frame?
He did not. I think that he only suggested that it was a mistaken identity, and he did not suggest why they would point to him as opposed to someone else. So, for all these reasons, because there was good cause to admit the hearsay statements and the documents, the written statements, and the screenshots of the online conversation during the probation violation hearing, any error committed by the Court of Appeals in conducting the harmless error analysis was, in fact, harmless. There was good cause to admit the out-of-court statements of the two young girls. And this court should affirm the decision of the circuit court and the Court of Appeals.
All right. Call the next case.